I'm Laura Harper Lake.
And I'm Sarah Reitzman, and you're listening to Creative Guts.
Hello there. Today we're talking to Big Ink, which is a dynamic duo of Lyle and Karen. They have this wonderful organization where they bring together artists and community organizations for public events that promote large-scale woodcut printing. I have known Lyle for 12 or 13 years now, and Karen almost as long, and they have been very driven creatives for as long as I've known them. Sitting down with them and hearing about their process and talking about the guts they had to cast away day jobs, quote unquote, and really go for this innovative, new, never seen before kind of business model for what they do creatively, artistically, was just amazing.
Yeah, this was a really fun one for us to record because we were really intrigued by what Lyle and Karen had to say, because we're talking about people who found a way to take their creativity, their artistic side, and really monetize it in this really cool, innovative way. Mm-hmm. And so this was super inspiring for me. And they managed to bake traveling into that like business cake, which is awesome.
Yeah, you don't see that a lot. No. So it's exciting. As we mentioned before, a few of our first episodes that we recorded on Creative Guts were recorded on more modest, humble equipment. And now we've done an upgrade and we sound pretty fantastic now. So this is one of those blessed early episodes. So just be aware that the audio quality is just, you know, it's trying its best. But keep listening and you will hear lots of stunning sounds from us and our wonderful guests.
I'm a big deal. No, I'm a big deal.
It's pretty uncontrollable. It's my money and I want it now.
So, thanks for coming, guys.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for inviting us. Yeah.
So this is the Creative Guts podcast, where we want to dig deep inside the gross parts of you to see what comes out.
Yep.
So why don't you introduce yourselves and tell us a little basic stuff about you guys.
Sure. I'll start. My name is Lyle Castonge. I'm a relief printmaker, artist primarily focused on birds, natural environments, or the natural worlds, what fascinates me. I've been making woodblock prints for about 10 years, and Karen and I live in Newmarket.
What about your creative guts?
Yeah, I'm Karen Burnett, and I am a musician and writer, and I live with Lyle, and yep, we've been together for a little bit over 11 years now. So
yeah, we should probably also say too that we're the directors of a program called Big Ink, where we help other artists create large-scale woodblock prints.
Yes, we're going to talk a bunch about Big Ink.
Yes, we
do, because there's some very awesome recent news that you guys probably want to share. Let's back up a bit and talk about your history as creatives. It's tough with two of you. You know, we're doing two at the same mm-hmm. time, but you guys can take turns or interject or whatever. But when did you guys both realize you were creative?
So I was about 8 years old when I started to really draw a lot. My oldest brother was really into comic books and things like that, cartoons. And he was the only creative person in my family. Everybody else, my mom owned a small business and my dad was a postal worker. I didn't go to a museum until I was in my 20s.
Wow.
We came from a really small town. But what I sort of looked up to my brother in that way. I appreciated like the fact that he was kind of making something out of nothing. And he actually ended up going and doing something totally different. Because I think he was spooked. You know, I think a lot of times people get spooked, like especially when they're like, you know, at that formidable age mm. and people are like, what are you going to do with your life? Like, are you going to be an artist?
You need to make money.
That makes no money,
yeah.
You know? So, but I was really, I just got inside my own head, you know, and I would sit at a desk for hours drawing more, you know, I would do that more often than I would do my homework. Mm. I would just do that, listen to music and kind of just chill. And I liked the idea that I could just like invent these on my own worlds, you know, like come up with my own characters. And I've always loved that, you know, like we have this innate ability to just like create something out of nothing, just like out of our head, which is what, you know, sort of drives me as a creative person.
As a young 8-year-old, do you remember specific inspirations that you drew from besides your brother and what he was into?
It was a lot of pop culture stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, so I was really into comic books too. Like, I really liked cartoons, you know, like my first drawings were like comic strips, like where I was trying to make like my own superheroes and things like that. Mm-hmm. And even when I was in high school, I had a few really, you know, fundamental teachers that like kind of helped me. The school that I went to was really small, but they recognized that I had a knack for it and I was like had a passion. And I think when you live out in sort of like a rural area, whenever they recognize somebody who has a passion for something, they're like, yes, like grab a hold of this person and like foster it.
Don't get lost in the woods.
Like yeah. So I was doing one of my English teachers had she commissioned me to do basically like a children's book for her niece. She had a 6-year-old niece. Cool. And she was like, oh, like I wrote this story, like would you want to illustrate it? And it was really cool. It was like fascinating to do that. So that, you know, sort of along the line, I feel really fortunate because at these different milestones in my life, I've had someone there that has been able to kind of step up as a mentor in that way and like kind of bring me along as I go. But yeah, it was all grounded in a lot of pop culture kind of stuff. So
when did the bug hit you, or remember?
Yeah, it was also very early on, like Lyle. I know, like, probably the earliest creative thing I can think of doing is playing the piano. I did that at age 5 is when I started, and I did that from 5 to 9. And then when I was 9 years old, I started playing guitar, which I've continued to do. I don't play piano anymore. I don't remember anything about it. But also early on, I remember being like age 7 and going to still life drawing classes at like the local park hosted. And there's just this wonderful teacher that I had there who was really inspiring. And so I also really enjoyed drawing like still life and like making realistic pieces. And so I also had like a lot of visual art. And then I also was a very avid reader. So I like to just spend a lot of time by myself as a child, really, like just making, you know, just doing a lot of creative stuff. So I don't know, at any point I really thought I was creative, like very early on. I just felt like it was this sort of wonderful thing that I was exploring and I was just so into it. Yeah. So, but on the thing of mentors, I would definitely say that when I was 11, for 2 years I studied jazz guitar. And then when I was 11, I got a new guitar teacher. And I studied with him for like 8 years. Wow. And like we'd meet once a week, and he was just an incredible, incredible teacher. And so I've taken so much from that, as well as several mentors in my writing. I write a lot of poetry. So I had a really great teacher in high school, English teacher, who was very encouraging. And he really got me interested in Bob Dylan and thinking of like how lyrics are like poetry and how all these sort of things are interconnected. And then I was also very fortunate to have a really wonderful poetry teacher and still mentor of mine in college. So yeah, it's really, really that encouragement is a really great thing to do. So
I love that you both reference being inspired or motivated by teachers or mentors. And then you teach the art of printmaking, mm-hmm. which is just very full circle. So you can give back what you got.
What's interesting too is there's sort of like a cutoff point where people have to kind of get real. You know, I've found through teaching that a lot of the times what happens is like people then circle back around mm-hmm. later in mm-hmm. life, like in their 40s, 50s, and they're like, I really wanted to, you know, do this when I was in my 20s, yeah. but then there was that get real moment, and now I'm sort of kind of, they feel like they're kind of catching up in a way.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, now I have to make up for my lost time.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, it's never too late to dive back into right. a passion. Hopefully there's enough mentors and great teachers out there letting people know that there are other avenues to be creative minded in your job or profession or whatever without sacrificing what you love.
Absolutely.
So I want to talk about Big Ink, but I think I'm going to save that towards the end because I want to talk about both of your individual focuses. So we're going to start with you,
okay.
especially musically, because I will let everybody know that I have had the honor, the privilege of making music with you. And it's an incredibly awesome experience because I play a little bit of music and I sing a little, and it's very rudimentary. And I just sort of like have to work as hard as I can. I wasn't really brought up with music, and it just comes out of your pores like nothing. Like you can just more. And
well, I have to say, it was a pleasure playing with you, and I hope that we get to have the chance to do it again.
Oh, yeah,
it's really great. I think doing it at such a young age, I think you really get it. There's part of it that goes into that sort of automatic pilot mode. There's certain things you don't have to think about when you're playing. You've done it for that long. So there's a level of, I guess, just the skill that's built into it. Yeah. I always feel like, though, I'm always learning. So it's still like, it's not like I am a master guitar player by any means. I still have a very long ways to go. So it's always trying to like learning something new. And I feel like music in particular, like both poetry and some other creative forms, can really hit this sort of emotion, this sort of sense of emotion that is really hard for us to express in our everyday lives. So I think it's just this sort of thing I love to dive into. And and some of it does go back to having a really great teacher that I had, because he played by ear, and he was, you know, ear trained. And I spent a lot of time with him bringing pieces. He's basically, I would go in once a week and he would say, I want you to bring in a song that you like. And I'd bring it in and he'd show me how to play it like every week. So it was this sort of thing, me just diving into this sort of music that I loved. And before that point, I was reading notations and doing all the formal sort of jazz stuff, which I want to return to at some point. But for him, he really just showed me this other way of thinking about like creating. You know, you don't have to follow all these rules and all these lines. Like, there's other ways to circumvent and tap into things. And then the last, probably the last year that we were together, I was, taking classes with him. I was about to leave for school, and then he had news that he had terminal cancer. So that was pretty difficult. But it was also sort of like turning point for him, I think, with him, you know, giving classes. And he had a lot of students, and he was just such a wonderful musician. He was like, I want to, he basically like set me aside and he's like, I want to show you how to play like improvisation. Mm-hmm. Like, I want to show you how to do it in the steps. So we really worked on that the last year. It just taught me so much. So I'm very grateful that I had the time to spend with him and what he taught me. So,
yeah. Sounds amazing. A very special relationship.
Yeah. And passing on that knowledge, I think, is really important too. These sort of things that you don't get, you know, every day, these sort of very special relationships. And I feel fortunate now because I'm able to continue playing the guitar and kind of return to it after hiatus. And now like I am doing a lot more improv now, and I'm kind of like applying a lot of things that I learned from him. So that also makes me, you know, I think of him sometimes, you know, as I'm playing. So, yeah.
Aww, I think he'd be very proud.
Oh, well, thank you.
So aside from our little project that we did, which was called Electric July. Go check it out on the RPM Challenge website. You're also in another band that you formed. I see a lot of stuff happening online with it. And you guys will be playing out a lot more. So tell us the name, because I think I'll butcher it if I say it. And then what the arrangement is and how it's progressing.
Yeah, so the name of the band is Kioia. And it's the name of a bird that went extinct in Hawaii in the 1800s. So it's kind of like this nod to extinction. You know, there's climate change going on. There's a lot of like hot topic things. Mm-hmm. Sort of, for me, the name, I was really interested in the history of the bird. And then when I did research about it, there wasn't much about the bird at all. It was just, there's like four specimens of this bird. And so I was kind of wondering like what else has gotten lost, you know, in the past, and especially as things change and are so rapidly developing nowadays. So it's sort of like, I'm feeling like I'm kind of giving the bird or the presence of this bird, like a sort of new song in some sort of way. Yeah. So, or any sort of music. So
that's beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah. I just thought a word with a lot of vowels, and I didn't ask any follow up questions.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful story.
Thank you. So I played the guitar in the group, and it's based on my original composition. So then there's also Jonathan Blakesley, who plays double bass on it, and then also Jim Ryu, who plays drums. So we're a trio, we're instrumental. It's sort of like surf rock sort of vibe, but also a little bit of psychedelic and throwback to like 1970s, like Turkish rock and roll. So there's a little bit of a sort of, I don't know, Eastern vibe to it too in some parts. So it does a little bit of everything. It kind of blends a lot of genres.
Would you let us play a little clip of it on this podcast?
Yeah, certainly. It may be, we're hoping to do some newer recordings, so you may at some point have like a more updated version. Okay. So this is definitely more the demo of what we have. Okay. But
here's some Kiyoya. Two mentions so far, not that I'm keeping a tally, but two mentions so far of birds. And I know you're bird people, and so one of our questions sort of talking about what influences you, and it sounds like birds are maybe an influence in other natural things.
Yeah, well, we have pet birds. So we have three birds. We have a dove. He's like, what, 15 years old? And then we have two. We have a society finch and a, what is it, a weaver? Orange weaver?
Yes. Or yes, yellow weaver. Orange weaver, yeah.
Orange weaver, yeah. So, Karen, you've always had birds, right?
I have, yes. Yeah, always.
So your folks had them, and that's kind of how you got into them.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, my mom was, at one point, she was a former veterinary assistant. Like, she worked, so she has, like, a background in, like, rehabbing animals. And so, I always had a ton of animals growing up. Yeah, so, but especially birds. We always had many different types of birds, so. Yeah, they've always been very special to me.
Yeah.
I had a parakeet when I was growing up. That was pretty much, I mean, she had more involvement with birds. I mean, birds are a relatively new thing for me. I started making bird imagery in like 2012 or something along those lines.
Was that when, a little after you guys were started dating?
Yeah. Yeah. So Karen already had birds. She sort of like brought them into our relationship. And I was like, these guys are awesome.
Something based on. Like, yes, they are. They are awesome.
So, yeah. But I've been sort of evolving now, and it's like still very much bird related, but I kind of like pushing more towards like general natural subject themes. Like the way human interaction like with the natural environment, like how that sort of like is evolving and changing in good and bad ways. So I'm sort of like kind of sort of moving in that direction too, but still a lot of bird stuff.
So birds are like an inspiration and something beautiful and also like part of your family.
Yeah, exactly.
It's pretty nice.
That's the way our entire like lifestyle is really, I mean, everything just sort of flows seamlessly into each other. Like our business, Big Ink, just started off as like we were just printing with friends, and then it kind of snowballed from that. And it's very much like our day is not structured in a way where like we wake up and like we start work at 9 and like we get done at 5. It's like everything sort of fluidly like goes into each other. And that's just the way we've lived our lives in terms of not only the subject matter of like our art, but like, you know, our business.
I met you many, many years ago at Chester College.
Mm-hmm.
So you went and applied to Chester for studio art or printmaking, or what was the discipline you were focusing on?
I think it was illustration. It was illustration. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And then you ended up leaving. I went to NHIA where you two met.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And when did printmaking really take a hold of you? When did you get into that?
Yeah, it was funny because I took an intro print course at Chester, but it didn't really appeal to me at the time. And then junior year of college was when I really started to do a lot of printmaking related things. And what was interesting for me was the process involved in it. I'd taken painting in all these different classes, but it was almost too immediate for me. I would get lost in the process as I was doing it, and I would constantly be correcting and sort of like, you know, trying to revise. And at the end of it, I would just be sort of overwhelmed. But with printmaking, I liked the idea that, you know, you started with like a very specific kind of process step by step. And at the end, you know, ideally, doesn't always happen, you would come up with some form of finished result. The nice thing about printmaking in a way is that even though you plan it all out and you think you've, you know, crossed your T's and dotted your I's, there's still surprises that come up in the end. And that's why it still remains really valid for me, is because even though I've been doing it for more than 10 years, there's still a lot of things that I haven't figured out. and Karen was talking about, you know, like mastering something. It's like, what is a master? I mean,
right.
If you're learning, if you're continuing to learn, that's sort of the driver. I mean, if someone has mastered something and they're sort of saying, I don't need to learn anything else, I feel like then maybe you need to move on to something else where you are continuing to learn.
And where do you continue to get your education from?
Well, it's mostly from the act of doing. Mm-hmm. Like, so I've always tried to push myself in a technical way with doing different color layering and, you know, trying to actually work like bigger scale with layering colors, different types of paper, different types of ink. There's so much that's involved with that. And at school, we learned the basics. You know, we didn't, like, it wasn't like a master training program where, like, you go in and they show you all of the things that you need to know. It was more like, oh, carve a plate and put some ink on it and, you know, like, run it through. And, like, that's a relief print. It wasn't like, this weight of paper does this. And, like, if it's, you have a thinner one, this does this. And so, in a way, I'm learning all of those things, like, through the process of making. And I'm really excited, actually, like within 20 years, you know, like where I'll be at that point, like, you know, have this more encompassing knowledge of the process. It's simple in its core, but there's so much nuance to it that, you know, it's a stamp, essentially. You're carving a stamp and you're printing on a paper, but there's a lot that you can do within the avenue. And I think actually the fact that it is fairly simple is better. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not overly complex. Like you can do different things and change it up. So.
And it's remarkable how much you can, like, some of the students I've seen will have pieces that have a lot of negative space, so they really focus on detail, but it's very simple. Mm-hmm. Or some of them, there's extreme texture and extreme detail, and you can, I imagine, spend way more time. You know, it's sort of versatile with size and amount of attention you put into it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of those things where the more time you put into it, the more you get out of it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's we have artists that come to us that we work with, and they'll be coming from like a painting background, something where they produce work quickly, and then they have to do this, and they're like, oh,
yeah,
this is going to take a lot of time. Like, I'm used to making a painting in like a week, and we're like, no, this is going to take you like 2 months to do this. So,
do you want to tell us the process of how, like, I'm an artist, I want to sign up for your class. What should I expect? Like, what does your business bring to folks all around the country?
Yeah. So first of all, what we do is a call for entry process. So we prefer not to call it a class because people have to actually be juried into it. And the jury process essentially looks at, you know, it's me and Karen that look at all the submissions. It's really to see if someone put the time in, you know, like to like craft a drawing that's, you know, well thought out, that they actually thought about how something would translate into a relief print. Mm-hmm. You know, like, for example, if they're submitting something in color and it's like grayscale, you know, we're like, okay, or color, you know, halftone or something. We're like, that's, you know, you have to go back and, you know, kind of reevaluate how you're submitting that. But so we go through proposals. We have we schedule events at different art centers and museums, galleries. An artist applies. If they're accepted, they pay a participation fee. So then it becomes almost like a class. Mm-hmm. And then what they do is they have 2 months prior to the event to actually carve the plate. And we give them a series of videos which basically walk them through the entire process. So one of the things that we always like to stress is you don't have to be an expert printmaker to be part of one of our events. We have all of the materials required in terms of like a knowledge base to get you from start of the product all the way to the end of it. So basically, you know, where you get the materials, where you buy them, you know, how to carve, like how to hold the tools, the different types of paper, different types of ink, like all of that is covered in our series. So then it is very much like it's like an online course in that way, and you follow along as you go. And then at the end of the 2 months, we meet up with all of the artists and we help them print their work onto paper. So there's typically 16 artists at an event. So another thing that we like to stress too is that we have an in-person component. Mm-hmm. Because there's a lot of things online nowadays where you can go take a class and it's sort of open-ended and there's no commitment involved in that. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I don't know what the percentage is of people that don't finish those classes. I bet it's pretty high. So what we do is we give people a deadline. We have to say, hey, you have to meet us at this place, you know, at this appointed day. And if you don't show up, you know, you're going to be put on the...
We're keeping your money.
You're going to be put on the wall of shame. No, but so it's a great motivator. Like a deadline is a great motivator. So what it does is, you know, it pushes people to not only complete the project, but, you know, they learn a tremendous amount in a fairly short period of time. Mm-hmm. And they go from, some people go from never having done it before, or maybe, you know, carving small little relief plates that are, you know, mm-hmm. like maybe they did it in school, and they're producing work that's like 3x5 or like 3x6. They're making these huge images. Mm-hmm. So at the end of the day, what's most appealing for us is we have someone that goes through that entire process, and then they're like, I'm already planning my next one. And that happens a lot, and it's so gratifying mm-hmm. for us to hear that, because we are, as one artist put it, sort of like the Johnny Appleseed of like woodblock printmaking, you know, like we're going out there and we're trying to, you know, we're sort of spreading the idea of it, and we're trying to bring it in front of people that have never done it before. Or maybe
you gotta do a print of Johnny Appleseed.
A Johnny Appleseed,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Right?
But exactly. He's got his printing press and he's like throwing out the prints of, to the people here.
Yeah. So that's like half of our business, and then the other half we do like contractual events. Uh-huh. So we'll go to a museum, or we'll go to like a university, and they'll have a group of students, or they'll have a group of artists that they've brought together. And it's the same idea, you know, they'll give us the list of people, we sort of like matriculate them into the program, give them all of the educational materials, and then we meet up with them. But there's no call for entry, there's no jurying in that right. part of the process.
So what happens with the carved wood block after you're done? There can't be that much value in stamping it a number of times. Can you continue carving into it, or maybe like, I don't know how it works, slice a layer and carve into it again?
Yeah.
Or does that just get wasted?
No, so the plate itself is actually the most valuable piece, because that's what you actually get your impressions off of. So a lot, so artists will, when they come to us, usually that's an initial proof. That's just, they haven't actually printed it. So that's the first time they're seeing it printed on paper. So usually they'll go back home and they'll make adjustments to it. And then they'll produce an addition of prints. So that could be anywhere from like, you know, half a dozen to maybe like 20 prints off of that block. And then they'll sell those. The plate itself, we've had people like actually hang the plate. A lot of the times people come to us.
I do. That's cool.
Yeah. A lot of the times, like at events when we're printing, people are interested in the process and they like the prints, but they're actually usually more interested in the plate. Mm-hmm. They want the plate itself.
That's interesting.
Because it's sculptural, you know, and it has that texture, and people love the tactility of it. So, and it's just like, you know, it's that big piece of wood. It's very imposing. And so people are.
But most artists don't sell their plates, because then people could reproduce their work, right?
Yeah. Traditionally, like, you know, way back in the day, they would actually cancel the plates out. So they would, at the end of the edition, they would either just cut the plate up so you couldn't print it again, or they would put like a huge X through it. They would just carve a big X across it to cancel it.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
So interesting.
Yeah.
What do you do with yours now?
I keep them.
Yeah.
I keep them. I mean, I went through this stint where I was doing these magicians, like a series of sort of vaudeville posters and things like that. And, you know, at a certain point, I moved on past that. So I did cut up most of those plates and I discarded them. I kept one and I hung it up on my wall. But most people hold on to them. You know,
and they're beautiful.
Yeah, yeah, I've seen I've seen some artists actually make them into like coffee tables. Like they'll just put a piece of glass on top of it and make it into a coffee table.
Well, I was thinking when you were finishing that sentence, like what? I was thinking if you put resin.
Yeah.
In that, keep it, but you also, no one can print it.
Yeah.
Right? Oh, that's beautiful. You could sell it that way if you wanted to, I guess. I always keep mine. I display mine. I only do little ones, but, you know.
Yeah.
And now in teaching, do you ever get influenced by any of your students?
Oh, yeah, all the time.
Yeah.
One of the best things about someone who's coming at it from a novice perspective is they're just sort of trying different things. Like they don't really know what they're doing. They don't know what the limitations of the medium are. So like I've had people that just like use dental tools. They're like, oh, like I have this like different picks or whatever. Like I'm just going to like scratch the surface. Or we've had people that have used different types of power tools that are really interesting. We had one person who just took different size punches and literally made an entire image by just using different punches to like punch out certain areas of the wood. You know what I'm talking about? It's like it's a circular thing and it has basically like a sharp edge to it, and you just
like a chisel almost?
It's sort of a chisel, yeah. but it's circular. So you just go into the wood and then you can like pop it out. Like, so they were using different size, like different diameters of punches to make like an entire image.
Does it almost look like pointillism?
It does, yeah. Wow. Yeah, it sort of looks like a dot matrix kind of thing.
Yeah.
So that stuff is just like fascinating. You're like, bad people that just like run over it. to see like the texture, you know, that's like yeah. that comes out of it. So
that's crazy. How do you guys stay motivated as individual creators, especially with it as a business?
Yep.
You know, like, is there ever any burnout? Is there any ever like, screw this?
Oh yeah.
Or screw you.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Well, there's certainly a burnout involved. I mean, I think when you're so the flip side of everything being so fluid is, you know, like, it's hard to pull away from it. Mm-hmm. You know, you're just engaged mm-hmm. with it all the time.
Yeah.
So I think in that way, the burnout factor really is mostly revolved around like when we have a series of events that are like all occurring at one time. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, right now, we have an event in Portsmouth this weekend, and then like 2 days later, we have to like go to Denver and do an event out there. So we have to coordinate, you know, like through 24 people. I'll speak for myself and then I'll let Karen speak. But in terms of like being motivated for our own work, the burnout is mostly from like an administrative standpoint. It's not like, oh, like I hate doing this. You know what I mean? Like, it's still really gratifying to like see the process and actually like produce the work. It's mostly just like emailing for like hours or whatever. You know what I mean? And again, having a deadline is great. Like, I'm having a solo show at a gallery in Brattleboro, and it's like, they need to have work by this date, and like, you have to produce it. You know what I mean? Like, you can't just be like, I'll do that later. Like, they're like, no, like, we need this stuff. Yeah. Like, and you have to do this.
Get your butt in line up.
So it's the same, you know, it's the same way for me too, as with all the participants that we work with, you know, like having that deadline or having like a goal in mind of something that you're trying to work towards is hugely, you know, beneficial. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And I say my situation is maybe slightly different than Lyle's, because like, I don't make prints. I've always helped Lyle with printing his work. So for me, whenever I'm feeling a little fatigued, you know, working with just all the administrative stuff with the business, I'm like, okay, I'm going to do my music now. So I have like a different sort of creative outlet. Mm-hmm. So I would think it'd be a little bit
harder. She has a separate room. She's like, I'm just going to close the door now. She's like, the door is closed. You can't come in now. It's like, okay.
And I think too, every time we do event, there is this big concentration of energy, and both like the artists that are excited to see their work printed for the first time is so magical.
Yeah.
And then also the public that comes in and they like learn about this for the first time. It's so like their eyes are just wide open. They're like, what is this? Yeah. And people get so excited. And so for me, then that kind of gives me my extra fuel for the day, you know, and like, okay, yes, we have more momentum now. We can go the next one. So it always kind of like, for me, that's always really inspiring to see everyone come together and everyone collaborate that day. So I think it's always like having that next event, while it's also, there's a lot of logistical things that come in and it can be a little like stressful, but it like pays off so well. You're like ready for the next one. So.
Yeah. And I don't know about you, but I definitely get like a high afterwards, like at when it's done, you're like, yes, like we did that. And like, it was great. Like, you know, and like the artists were really happy.
It's
and like,
so
they were
satisfying
excited.
To see like someone's face, you know, the artist's face when they see their piece printed for the first time, because they have like so much time and personal investment in it. Mm-hmm. And it just makes me so happy that we were able to help them like bring that piece into the world, you know? So
it's an accomplishment.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's other people there to share it with them. I think that's really important.
Yeah.
You know? Like, not only other artists, but like the public could come in and be like, what you did was like amazing. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think that people could hear that enough, you know?
Like,
you did an excellent job with this. Cause when you're at home in your studio and you're working all by yourself and you're like, when am I ever going to finish this? You know, and you bring it there and it's done and people are like, you know, the pat on the back, like, it really does make a big difference for people.
You finally birthed it out.
Yeah. Now yeah, exactly.
To make all the noise at once. I'm curious about, Laura and I talk all the time about how we wouldn't be able to work with our husbands. And so I'm curious about, like, being able to work together as a couple and also living together and also balancing sort of your work-life balance and balancing the creative parts and the administrative parts and how that all looks like.
Yeah, it's funny because everybody that we know are creative types of people and they're artists and, like, you know, they own businesses and they're doing their own thing. So whenever we meet up with them, it's just like this total, like, oh yeah, like, you're dealing with this too, right? Yeah. We're all going through the kind of like that same thing. So there's like a camaraderie around that. But like kind of what Karen was saying, you know, we have different outlets. You know, like she has her music. Mm-hmm. Like we play volleyball. Like, yeah. You know, like I go biking like four times a week on the trail. Like, do you want to talk a little bit about the relationship and the,
yeah, how much do you hate Lyle on some days?
It's pretty bad. It can be pretty intense sometimes.
Oh dear. Yeah, I better plead the fifth. No,
on Sundays, like you have your music thing, so she'll be gone. Like, she's usually gone most Sundays doing music. Yeah. So.
And Lyle's like very understanding too, because we have a lot of things that we have to get done that's time contingent. And when I'm like, I really, you know, I need to have this time to go do something else, like I appreciate that he's very understanding of that. So, yeah.
But no, right now.
I would say that I feel like since we've gone to so many different venues and art centers and just people we've met who are creative, I'm just amazed by the amount of creative couples that are out there. They're like power couples. And I feel like it's really hard to make it. I don't know how you'd make it on your own as like a creative individual. It's really tough. So there's always like, I feel like, somebody else, you know, behind the scenes, like supporting that person in some way, either like emotionally or whatever. Yeah.
What do you think? What do you feel when you look at your pieces?
Really tired.
That took 75 hours. That's
really tired. And usually at the end of it, I'm thinking, because like the whole process evolves as you go, I just think at the end of it, I'm like, how did I even do that? And then especially a few years later, like, I have no idea how I did that. Like, what color did I mix to make that?
I always feel like with my creative stuff, I'm like, oh, if I could do this, or I feel like so much of it for me is like just the learning process.
The experience.
Yeah. And then I'm just like, okay, well, next time I'm going to try this and this. So yeah, it's funny. It's hard for me to like look back, and have something like that stands out to me. Mm-hmm. So,
what's one of the best times you've played out in public where you felt it extraordinary after or during?
That's a good question. I feel like I need to play more out before I get to that point. Yeah.
Open mics or things like that, you know.
I guess one thing I can say, which it's not necessarily music related, but well, last year I was the Arts and Culture Laureate in Newmarket. Yeah, at the Arts Center, Civic Center, Mill Space, a center for art, history, and culture. And I was their first laureate. So I initiated this community project that dealt with these little poetry shadow boxes that I created that were inspired by snippets of poems. And I made these little dioramas. It was about an 8x8 inch shadow box. And I made about 23 of them. And I exhibited them in the space. And the public was welcome to come in and read these little lines of poetry. And then they were encouraged to write a line about their favorite box and anonymously submit it. So it was going to be like, there's no names involved. And so I had built up all this material over time, about 2 months of all this community contributed writing. And I distributed it to local poets. And they were then given the task of making a poem out of all this, you know, anonymous writing that they received. So in September of last year, we had a big poetry reading celebration. Mm-hmm. We had a slideshow showing all the poetry boxes and the poet read their poetry themed piece. And so that was like a pretty big thing for like a memorable experience for me, because I was bringing in a few people that I knew really well as far as writers who were participating. And then I had a lot of writers on the fringe that were like friends of friends. And, you know, it really kind of brought them close to like this, making this new poem that they wouldn't have made otherwise or been like encouraged to have done. And a few of the pieces have gotten published in different publications afterwards. So I was like, oh, that's really sweet, you know, that that is having like another life after the project.
So one of the hardest things about when you're an artist and you, oh, I want to make a career out of this, or I want to have a professional career, like that's super hard to do. That's not an easy thing. And you guys have, you know, lightning in a bottle. You have found this awesome, beautiful thing that was never in existence. How did you take that leap? Oh, we're going to make this a business. We're not going to have day jobs. This is our day job.
Took a lot of time. Yeah. Took a lot of time to get to that point. Yeah.
It did. Yeah. I mean, it was actually, a lot of the friends that we know that are professional artists sort of have similar stories where it was like they worked like a full-time job and they had an idea for something. And actually, a lot of startups start like that. You know, you work a full-time job and then you kind of, you work down to part-time. And then once like the amount of energy that you're spending on like your startup or your idea is like absorbing more of your like out of work time or even like starting to go into your part-time job, you know, you're on your lunch break, like taking phone calls for something related to your startup idea, then you have to take a leap of faith.
Yeah, because it was gamble, more. Yeah, you know, it was more
throw the dice in a way.
Well, but Big Ink started more as a personal project in 2012, and it was from that point until till we were doing, you know, various amounts of jobs plus Big Ink in certain like hour levels, and it's like slowly lowering all the other stuff and amping up on the Big Ink stuff until we moved here and
2017.
In 2017 in New Hampshire. So that's when things really took off, and we're doing it full time. Yeah. We're making this work, and it was just nice to be able to move and be like, okay, so this is it. That's kind of when we did make the big leap. It took a long time, very slow growth to get to that point. So
yeah, and we still wear a lot of different hats. I mean, we do Big Ink stuff, we teach classes, like I sell artwork. The artists that can just live off of selling their artwork, kudos to them, because I've met a lot of artists and I've met very, very few that just make a living off of selling artwork, like in galleries and stuff. Like it's super tough. So as with every, with all the artists that we've run into, it's kind of the similar story. They're like, I do like a little bit of this, a little bit of that, you know, and like I pull it all together into this sort of kind of cohesive thing, you know, that we do. But it's an adventure, you know, it's one of those types of things that there is no safety net, you know, like you're there, you're doing it, and you have to go at it full force, or else that's it. So
sounds scary.
It is scary. It is scary. Yeah, I mean, it's not scary in like lose like a place where we live, or we're not going to be able to like buy food or anything. It's not like that, but you know, there is a certain certainty, like when you have a full-time job and you know, like, hey, like this is like I've got this, and I know like if I come to this place every day, like I'm gonna get a paycheck. With what we do, it's, you know, it's like we have to make sure that we're thinking, you just have to think really long range, like about whatever your plans are, projects, things like that. Like you have to be thinking like what's going to be happening at this time next year, or like the year after that. Like you have to be like on top of that. So.
And so I hear through the grapevine that you've got a bit of an injection of cash flow recently.
Yeah.
How did that come about? I wonder.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So we were participants in the Granite State Growth Competition, which was hosted by the Regional Economic Development Center.
Spoiler alert, that's where Sarah and I work at.
I wasn't sure if you wanted me to say
no,
that.
No, so I'm just being goofy.
Yeah. Yeah.
But REDC, the Regional Economic Development Center, did a growth pitch competition this year for the first time ever. And we had 34 businesses apply, with only 10 making it to the actual pitching. From that, 7 were selected to move on, then 5, and then 1 final winner. And guess who that was, Sarah?
I have no idea.
It was Big Ink.
Big Ink.
Oh, I'm so surprised. So tell us about that process.
We should probably preface it by saying that we have never done a pitch competition. We never pitched to anybody. So we were total novices, and probably what, 3 months ago now, something along that lines, we had a workshop where we, the REDC, Chris at the REDC was, and some of the other advisors there sort of like talked about like how to deliver a pitch, you know, and like the nuances of like what you should be telling people within 5 minutes about your business. So the whole thing had to be synthesized down in 5 minutes. One of the things about what we do, which was, you know, really difficult, was, you know, we're not selling a product where we're like, here's the product. You know, you buy the product for X amount of money. This is how much we've sold. It was like more about trying to describe like, here's an artistic process. this is like the history of the artistic process. This is how you actually make things. And then this is like the community of people that we're building around that. So to do that within 5 minutes was like really daunting. During that entire process, I think what we learned was not only to synthesize our message down so that we could speak about our business more concisely, but also we spent so much time reflecting on like what is important in our business. Like what is it that we want people to know about what we do within 5 minutes, like that we should be hitting home. And it was extremely rewarding. And our presentation, we had to do 3 separate rounds of pitches. And in between the second and third round, we had a Q&A with the judges, which was like incredibly helpful. So the first presentation that we did looked nothing like the final presentation that we did. And it was incredible to just see, you know, at the end when we won, you know, to talk to some of the people that had seen some of the original presentations, and they were like, that was nothing like the original, like you changed everything. Yeah. You know, they were like,
we basically started with like a blank slate after we talked to the judges. So we got to redo this, we're redoing the slides, redoing the angle of, you know, the, what this business means. So it really hit at the core of that. So,
but it was good because both Karen and I are very like self-driven individuals. Mm-hmm. So when we would like do a presentation or when we got the advice from the judges, like once we left there, we were like, all right, like what about that went well? Like what do we need to improve upon? And then when the judges gave us feedback, it was like, oh, it was just like the window was opening. Like, oh, you should be doing this. And then we're like, we need to scrap like our entire thing and just start over. Like this is not what we, you know, we need to be conveying this in a different way. And then when we did that, and then on that final presentation, it was just really gratifying to like look out into the audience and see these people who knew nothing about what we did, or they didn't know anything about printmaking, but they were like engaged in it and they were like interested. And to have that in 5 minutes and people to be excited about what you're doing was just like amazing. So
And I think too, to have some of the people in the audience say, come up to me afterwards and say, I want to learn how to do this. That made me so happy to hear. I was like, yes, we got our message across about the importance of this program and what, you know, how it changes people's lives. Just so grateful for the opportunity to have done it.
So what came out of that entire process, which was so helpful, was the fact that, you know, we've built Big Ink up basically between the two of us, you know, just like coming up with ideas, like, you know, throwing things at the wall and see what sticks. And to have the outside feedback was huge, you know, hugely helpful. And we're like, you know, we want that. Like, we're not the type of people where we feel like, oh, we have this all figured out. Like, we don't need you. We don't need your advice. Like, we want people to give us their feedback. So we are using those funds for a marketing and branding campaign. And on just this past week, we met with an individual who is the head of the company who's going to be doing the marketing and branding. And, you know, just to have the interaction with somebody who's not like us, you know, who's like, oh, like, what do you have for materials? You know, and we like show him and he's like giving us feedback, telling us what we should be doing. And he's like, I'm going to put together like a whole, you know, a whole scope for you of like what we can do. And like, you know, it's really exciting because
it is,
because then it's like just another cog, you know, kind of like in the machine of like what we're trying to do. And the more cogs we can get, the more people on board, the more we can do with it. So
The more your message is going to be amplified.
We're really excited about that.
Your presentation was totally inspiring at the pitch competition and was so eloquently done by both of you. But my favorite part was actually your reaction right after you won. That video is so priceless.
Oh, where I was carrying Karen around.
I said, Laura, you made me.
Like, she wanted to kill
her. She was like, put me down. She was like,
well,
screaming.
I was worried someone was going to be able to look at my dress. So
I wasn't picking you up that.
I know. I was just being self-conscious. But I said, Laura, you made me look like a rag doll. I was crying.
He couldn't contain his joy. It was extremely authentic. Everyone was like beaming smiles because they felt how excited and happy you were.
We were so nervous because everybody did such a great job on his pitch. This is going to be a tough call for the judges.
I think it was close. I think it was very close. Like, I mean, I knew. Yeah. I didn't. And there was tons of press right after. You guys were in a lot of papers and online articles and stuff. So.
Yeah.
So that's good too. Just even more exposure, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's awesome. Great.
We were like, talk to our publicist.
Yeah.
All the cameras were flashing.
We're like, Oprah next week. Like,
get in the Escalade. We're out of here.
So to conclude this train, we're going to be doing some rapid fire questions. Favorite color?
Blue.
Gray.
I love that. You said it so hesitant.
With such confidence.
I'm
going to
believe
you.
This is my favorite color. Favorite sound?
I love to say, I mean, right now at the moment, I like the woodcock sound that's on my phone, the quacking sound.
That's my mom's ringtone.
Is
when
it?
She calls
that's
me.
Is it really?
A duck when I grew up.
Oh, yeah.
That's
my favorite
name. Oh, that's cute.
Yeah, I know.
Birds, there it is again.
And we did birds, interviewed Rose Bryan, and her favorite sound was birds.
Was it really?
Oh, that's sweet.
Favorite scent?
Lavender.
That was one of Rose's, too.
Really? Yeah.
Lavender's nice.
Wow. I like rosemary. The scent of rosemary.
That's so funny.
That was her other one, yeah.
She said it's rosemary, no lavender. A combination of those two.
Oh,
nice. Wild. There's something being channeled in the air here, maybe. That's crazy.
She's like piping it in right now.
Yeah, right?
Karen loves lavender, actually. Yeah.
And patchouli, too. I like patchouli a lot. Maybe a combo, but yeah.
Favorite texture?
Oh, I know that one. I love the feel of like peaches. That what? I'm just saying, it's like that
you
velvety.
Are so ready for
it's
this
got that thing. Velvety. It's got that velvety feel to it. You know what I'm talking about? Yeah, like our nectarines or whatever. I love that.
That's
feel.
A really good answer. Wow.
I like the feel of like feathers, not feather, not like a feather boa, but like petting, like petting my pet dove. I think that's very so soothing. Sweet. Yeah.
Aww. Every time we go to the grocery store, I'm always like. Fondling the nectarine. I'm like, Karen, we're not going to buy this, but feel this peach.
They call security over to the fruit section.
There's some fruit. There's some weird guy over here.
Peach feeler.
Like, seriously, feel this. It's so soft. It's like crushed velvet.
If you could go back in time when you first started making art, making music, or writing, what advice would you give your younger artist self?
I would say, okay, I know what I would say. I would say, you know, do some workshops. Like I would say, you know, like start with workshops and see what you like before you go into school. Just
that's great advice.
Yeah.
Oh, geez. Yeah. Keep on trucking. It's like, well, I keep on thinking. Like, don't just keep on going. I don't know. I think one thing, too, which I'm still, like, working on is, like, to... lower the voice of your inner critic, because I feel like with me, I definitely like always struggle with that. I'm like, oh, that could be better. That could be better. But sometimes like you just need to enjoy the moment. So that's something I feel like I'm still working on, but
also,
I would tell my younger self that.
Yeah. Also finish your projects. You know, sometimes people just like abandon it because they get discouraged or whatever. They're just like, this isn't good enough, you know, just like finish them.
So, again, thank you guys for sharing your wisdom and creativity and talent with us. You both inspire me musically and artistically, and business-wise, you inspire me. So, you know, I feel lucky to be your friend and to have you on this podcast.
Mm. Aww. Oh, thank you.
Sweet. And you folks should definitely check out biginc.org to find out all the awesome stuff that they produce and all their events coming up.
Thank you.
All right, so with that,
show us your creative guts.
And you cutie pies, you know what inspired me to have us do that? Your presentation. I said to Sarah, like, oh my God, we should have a thing where we say this thing at the same time. It was so powerful when you ended that way. So
we did it at the beginning, too. We really doubled down on it.
Yeah, exactly.
Big thank you to Lyle and Karen of Big Ink for sharing their stories with us today. If you want to know more, visit biginc.org and find Big Ink on Facebook and Instagram. If you want to hear more about us, Creative Guts, we're available on all major podcast platforms, but feel free to find us on Facebook as well, where we'll be sharing silly, crazy selfies of ourselves and guests. If you want to know more about biginc.org, oh, if you want to... I can't read. I think you should replace me. Okay. If you want to know more about their amazing... that's all I say. If you want to know more about their process or...
their warm process.
If you want to find out... Wow, now it's just stuck.
Laura's a mess.
If you want to know more, visit biginc.org and find Big Ink on Facebook. The unraveling of a human being. That's what you're witnessing. Maybe you should do that
podcast. We're renaming this podcast. Listen to Laura unravel live on air.
Why can't I say it? What's wrong with me? Yeah.